Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm strong to the finish, cause I eat my spinach. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
From Steamboat Willie to The Simpsons, there's no doubt about it. Music and cartoons go together like, well, Popeye and olive oil. Today on the show, we kick off a week-long series, Animating Music, about the relationship between cartoons and tunes. Also today, a live performance from Trinidadian trumpeter Etienne Charles and his band. But to begin, from Mickey Mouse to Bugs Bunny to the rock band Gorillaz, music and animation play well together, but none of it would be possible without Max Fleischer, a pioneer in the field. His studio gave us characters like Popeye, whom you're hearing in the background, and they also helped develop the very technologies that made sound animation possible. Now, in a few minutes, we'll focus on some of the hot jazz and sultry stylings of the Fleischer's leading lady, Betty Boop. But first, let's find out how all this began. Joining me on the line from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, is music historian Daniel Goldmark, author of the book Tunes for Tunes, Music in the Hollywood Cartoon. Daniel, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So if we're going to do a whole week of talking about music and cartoons, why is Max Fleischer a good place to start?
Max Fleischer is a great place to start because he was involved with cartoons in this country from basically from the very beginning. I mean, his history and his involvement with animation goes all the way back. I mean, with the technology that he helped develop, early experiments putting together sound and music, early experiments on animating the very form, creating some very, very important characters. I mean, he's pretty much one of the key figures, aside that other guy that you'll probably talk about later, that Disney fellow.
That Disney guy, yeah. We'll cover him tomorrow. But it sounds like Fleischer was on a similar trajectory to Walt Disney in the early years of animation. Fleischer gets there first in terms of sound and vision coming together. Is that right?
Yeah, you could say first. I mean, it depends on how you want to look at, if it's the thing that everybody knows or it's the first person to really do those experiments. I mean, Fleischer is experimenting with sound in the mid-20s at the very latest. He works with the inventor Lee DeForest, who is a very important innovator in radio, among other things, on trying to put together the idea of having synchronized sound with film. DeForest was pitching this all over the place with all different kinds of films, and one of the things he thought would be good would be to have some cartoons that had synchronized sound, and the Fleischers had a very successful series of cartoons where they took pop songs and put the words up on the screen and had people sing along with them. The bouncing ball cartoon that most folks probably are familiar with, even today you see it in commercials. It's still a great way to get people to, you know, bring home that whatever you're trying to sell, put the words on the screen, get them to sing along, and it always works. I actually remember a used car salesman from when I was a kid. I can still sing that tune because they put those words on screen.
Well, we actually have one of those. This is one of Fleischer's car tunes, pun presumably intended. This one called I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles.
Well, folks, we're all cleaned up for that old popular song, I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles. The orchestra will play the music, you sing the words, and I'll beat the time like this.
You just heard what Funny Boy said. Now sing along, folks. The trick is in following the bouncing ball. It's very simple. Let's see how well you can do it. Everybody ready? Let's go!
They're born anew,
That is one of the Follow the Bouncing Ball songs and animations that came out of the Fleischer studio, headed by Max Fleischer, as early as the mid to late 20s, although this one, I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, is from 1930. Excuse me. And Daniel Goldmark is on the phone with us, author of the book Tunes for Tunes, Music and the Hollywood Cartoon, as we kick off our week-long series, Animating Music. So this idea, fairly simple, I mean, at least in concept, if not in execution, Max Fleischer doing animation and his collaborator Lee DeForest had this idea to sync up sound. What, Daniel, was animation like before that?
You mean music and animation?
Yeah.
There's, you know, it's funny, there. I've spent years looking at this, and, you know, every once in a while, something small will sort of pop up, but music in film, and particularly music in animation, isn't something that people spent a terrible amount of time talking about. I mean, there's plenty of people who talk about how to accompany films and what's good music for that, but cartoons and other short subjects and newsreels, they're less concerned with those kinds of things. A lot of people looked at these short subjects as throwaways. You know, you would see it one week and you probably would never see it again. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know that much. There are some things we know. A lot of the cartoons would have been, were seen as being very similar to comedies, to screen comedies. And there is a lot, well, what little writing there is, people will say, you know, it's good to have a pop tune to throw in that people will recognize. And often they would use songs where the titles would match up with something that was going on. So the one you just played, I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, would be perfect if something is happening that involves bubbles or somebody getting really big or floating away or balloons or anything that has to do with that general idea. Because even though the song, that song is from 1918, even in 1930 when that bouncing ball cartoon is made, people still recognize the song.
Right.
They know the tune, they know the words, and that's enough to give a gag, to get the gag in someone's mind.
Now, when you talk about I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles while something with bubbles is happening on the screen, we call that Mickey Mousing, don't we? That kind of, you know, when something is that lockstep, in the visual and the music together.
Mickey Mousing often refers to lockstep is the perfect word to use, where you have the image and the music totally synchronized. In fact, it's so synchronized that it calls attention to itself, which is why it's something they really don't like in live action film. Mm-hmm. Hollywood features hate Mickey Mousing because it calls attention to the music, but the very term tells you where it came from. The early Mickey Mouse cartoons, where Carl Stalling's scores primarily were so synchronized to the action that it was as if one could not exist without the other. The music, tying the title of the song to what was going on, is less to do with Mickey Mousing and more to do with what a lot of silent film accompanists did, which was, and a lot of people thought this was kind of cheating or maybe punting, is to say, okay, well, here's a, you know, someone's walking into a church, so you have something that has church in the title or something about religion, food songs for when someone's eating, et cetera, et cetera. Carl Stalling was notorious for this, and I'm sure you'll talk about that another time. But
we'll be talking about Carl Stalling, yeah, later in the week. But what about someone like John Zamechnik, a name not nearly as well known as Carl Stalling, but he would have been one of the guys prior to sound and video being linked up. He would have been one of the guys who created some of the music that you would have heard in cartoons, right?
That's right. In fact, my understanding of his name is it's Zamechnik, although I've heard about 10 different versions, so they're probably all right. Zamechnik was a composer, actually born where I'm at in Cleveland, and went and trained overseas, came back here, and ended up writing for a publishing company, Sam Fox, whose main output was stock music for silent films and for cartoons, which is music for bad guys, music for Indian chases, music for funerals, music for birthdays, music for everything. Often it would be stuff pretty much ripping off the classics, but leaving enough there so you knew what it was. But Zamechnik was good enough that he actually, and prolific enough, that he wrote literally thousands of pieces under several pseudonyms, actually.
With a name like Zamechnik, who could blame him?
Well, and they really wanted to make the company seem like it wasn't just him, mm-hmm. which I think for many years it was. You know, every possible situation he wrote a piece for, and lots of other companies did this. Sam Fox was clearly the leader, and his music shows up in hundreds, if not probably thousands, of films and cartoons during the sound era. And this was stuff that was originally written for silent film. So you have to imagine that every major film accompanist, pianist, organist, band director around the country probably had either music by Zamechnik or some other composer writing this stock mood music in their collection. And the bad guy comes out and ties the heroine to the tracks, and we have to have some kind of hurry-slash-suspense music that is going to do the job and get everyone worried before the hero rides in, and we switch to the next piece. And this is exactly how cartoons are constructed, little pieces of music that we can recognize that tell us exactly what's going on.
So, for example, this is a Zamechnik piece, and it's called simply, and for reasons that will become very obvious now, Hurry Music. So in the early days of silent films and silent cartoons, if you had a score, it was usually being played live by the theater organist or pianist or band, and very often they were playing some of this music by John Zamechnik. So the Hurry music, for example, there. Once again, speaking with Daniel Goldmark, author of Tunes for Tunes, Music in the Hollywood Cartoon. And so this is all before Max Fleischer and the Fleischer Studios come along, and they sync up sound with the cartoons, and you know, at this point he's sort of creating some iconic characters in the canon of cartoons, of American cartoons.
That's right. His first big character, and one that a lot of people may not be familiar with, is Coco the Clown, and that, you know, he's really the predominant character who actually interacts with Fleischer on screen. These were the Out of the Inkwell series, and a lot of the silent cartoons did this, where it was a mixture of live action and animation. Disney would do the same thing with his Alice series in the 20s. You know, it's something that became familiar once again when Roger Rabbit sort of reinvigorated Hollywood animation in the late 80s, but mm-hmm. it was actually one of Hollywood's oldest, or animation's oldest techniques, was to have the back and forth between the two universes, if you will. So Coco hops out of the inkwell, mayhem ensues, Max stuffs him back in, or he goes in on his own, and then we go to the next one.
And at some point, his sidekick becomes the superstar, and that is Betty Boop.
Right, and Betty is actually created as a sidekick for Coco's other sidekick, which was Bimbo, the dog. And then they decided
to
give...
So she was the sidekick to the sidekick.
Right, because if you look at the first couple of Betty Boop cartoons, she's actually a dog. You can see her. She has dog ears. Mm-hmm. And very quickly they realize we should turn her into a human flapper and not just a dog flapper, and that she just takes off from there.
And how soon before she has to have her own sound as well as her own look?
Well, she had her own sound very early on. I mean, her... And there's a lot of discussion about this, and some debate that where her sound came from. It's from a couple of different stage and screen stars. Helen Kane was probably the most famous of them, who that particular approach to her voice and the little girl sound that she created.
The point being that people circa 1930 would have gotten the sort of reference when they heard the sound of Betty Boop talking and the sound of the music.
Right, right.
Okay. Well, this is from 1932, and this is Betty Boop with Boop Boop a Doop.
Now, There's a little queen on the animated screen. Wait till you get a view of sweet Betty. Made of pen and ink, she can win you with a wink. Wait till you get a view of sweet Betty. Those eyes, that pretty nose, and oh, aside from this, she's got so much of those. If you want to see just a perfect little she, wait till you get a view of sweet Betty.
Already the big show starts off with an evening. Oh, get going to the red wagon.
From the Betty Boop cartoon series, Boop Boop a Doop from 1932. We'll talk more about Betty Boop and specifically the jazzy sound of much of Betty Boop's music in just a moment as we continue with our animating music series. But Daniel Goldmark with us on the line. And Daniel, you know, Fleischer and his studio, they create Betty Boop, they create Popeye, they do Superman. The 1930s, they're really on an upward trajectory, and then it all comes crashing down in the early 40s. What happened?
Yeah, again, a lot of discussion about that. They, you know, with the success of Betty Boop, and they actually, Popeye had actually existed as a comic strip, or, I'm sorry, as a newspaper strip, and the Fleischers, you know, put him on screen, and he becomes huge. In fact, he first appears in a Betty Boop cartoon. And then they licensed the Superman character as well, but the studio had moved down to Florida, and they were trying to really battle Disney at his own game in a way, which was to, you know, make the next great big picture. And Disney does Snow White, and so Fleischer's do Gulliver's Travels, which is, you know, hugely successful, but there were a lot of internal problems and financial issues, and they do a second feature, Mr. Bug Goes to Town, but by the time that's happening, the studio is pretty much falling apart. And so by the early 40s, the studio essentially goes out of business and is almost entirely bought out by a Hollywood studio and reborn under another name. And they continue making Popeyes and plenty of other shorts, but the Fleischers are no longer part of that picture.
So they're sort of their swan song as these two feature-length films. As you say, Gulliver's Travels, pretty successful at the time, but now which one do we remember? We remember Snow White, the Disney film. And on the program tomorrow, we will talk about Walt Disney's rise, concurrent with that of Max Fleischer. But whereas Max Fleischer sort of disappeared from the scene in the early 40s, Disney, of course, would go from strength to strength. That's our next program in the animating music series. We've been speaking with Daniel Goldmark, who teaches at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, author of the book Tunes for Tunes, Music and the Hollywood Cartoon. Daniel, thanks for getting us started on our animating music series.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
When heights are high, the time will fly, so whistle while you work.
So tomorrow, more about Snow White, the Seven Dwarfs, the legacy of Disney. But next, we continue our conversation about the early era of animation and music, and we focus in on one genre in particular, jazz. And speaking of jazz, later in the show, trumpeter Etienne Charles plays with his band live in the studio. This is Soundcheck.
No chair, no table. The condition is terrible. And apart from that, no hot water to take a bath, and believe you sleep like a rabbit, a dirty sheet with half of a blanket.
Oh, how am I doing? Tweet, 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 wah.
How am I doing? Tweet, 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 twat, twat. Oh, how am I doing?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now on the early animation work of the New York-based family animation group known as the Fleischer Studios. And we've heard how this family-run studio helped popularize many of the technologies that made sound animation possible. Let's focus now on the the hot jazz that became the trademark cool sound of the Fleischer Studios. In the background, you're hearing the character of Betty Boop with Don Redman in a 1932 duet. In the studio with me is music writer Wild Friedwald. Will, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hey, it's a delight, especially with Professor Goldman.
So how did the sounds of what was at the time some pretty cool jazz come to be the sound of Betty Boop?
Like Daniel said, they were, even in the silent era, there was always a tendency to put popular music to animated cartoons, particularly a song title that people would know. And obviously, when they actually added pre-recorded sound to animated film, they continued that trend. One thing I've always wondered about is if the Fleischer brothers themselves were really big jazz fans, or it was a coincidence that they happened to be associated with Paramount Pictures, which had a facility in New York and which was very much involved in using popular singers and popular bands in their short subjects and in their feature films like the big broadcast. They used band leaders like Cab Calloway, who was probably the most prominent was Cab Calloway, obviously. And they used him in both short subjects and feature films and, you know, all kinds of stuff, including animated films. It was sort of a natural extension for Paramount Pictures, you know, to use, you know, the bands and singers that they had under contract in all these different formats. And so it was just sort of a fortunate accident that the Fleischer brothers happened to be producing cartoons that were distributed by Paramount Pictures. So you have to wonder if, you know, the brothers really went out of their way to include jazz music in their films. But it certainly was a very, very serendipitous coincidence because it worked very well.
Well, you know, and Daniel was also talking about how when they moved from New York down to Florida, things began to go south both literally and metaphorically.
Well, it's interesting.
And maybe getting away from all the musicians in New York had an impact.
Well, certainly one of the comparisons that's always made, and people always, I mean, obviously our comparison point for the whole history of animation, even up to this very day, is Walt Disney. And, you know, you can always compare anything that has ever happened in that medium to whatever Disney was doing at that point, because he's a very valid point of comparison. But it's easy to see that, you know, the Fleischer films, you know, both visually, you know, almost every scene in a Fleischer cartoon takes place on a street somewhere, whereas almost every scene in an early Disney cartoon takes place in a barnyard or in a country. You know, that just represents their growing up. You know, the Fleischers were New York Jews, and that was the world they knew. And, you know, Walt Disney was from the Midwest and settled in California. It was even sunnier and even more, you know, farm-like at that point. And, you know, they just were reflecting what they knew. And the music is the same way. The music in the Fleischer films is very urban, very gritty, very African-American, whereas the music in, you know, the Disney cartoons, since he was not affiliated with somebody like Paramount Pictures who could give him, you know, access to that sort of thing, a lot of it is old, you know, barnyard melodies and things like that, old folk songs, you know, whatever he had, whatever was public domain.
But with Max Fleischer, as you say, you know, through the Paramount Pictures connection, he had access to people like
famously Cab Calloway. I mean, Calloway did three cartoons for Max Fleischer, and he was so popular that images of Cab Calloway appear in other people's cartoons. They appear in Warner Brothers cartoons too. He was so well known that you could have, you know, anybody singing "Heidi High" and everybody in the universe, everybody in, you know, in France. He had an amazing following. He was like the Jerry Lewis of his day. He was totally known all over the world. You just have somebody saying "Heidi High" and somebody else answering back, and anyone, people in Antarctica knew that was Cab Calloway. It was an automatic cultural reference. And he did three cartoons for the Fleischers, and one of which, the most famous one, is his theme song, Minnie the Moocher, and he appears as a singing walrus, which is a wonderful image. It's a totally, totally narcotic image. And, of course, the story about Minnie the Moocher is that, you know, it's based on a song, sort of a jazz age elaboration of an old song called Willie the Weeper, and it's about a girl that smokes dope and has all these, you know, wild visions. And that is sort of the underlying theme of a lot of Cab Calloway songs from that period. And you have to assume the Fleischers had no idea what was going on. They produced all this, like, hallucinogenic imagery, but I don't think they were going out and smoking dope themselves, as far as I know. But I actually saw Calloway once live in the 70s, and I asked him about that, and he still remembered it. In fact, he said, "I am the walrus." No, he didn't say that. But he said,
It would have been a great.
It would have been appropriate, you know. Yeah. It's just as hallucinogenic.
You know? You can see what Will is talking about because we have Betty Boop and Minnie the Moocher on the Soundcheck webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And here's what it sounds like: Cab Calloway and Betty Boop from 1932.
I'm not afraid. Are you Bimbo?
No.
Folks, now here's
about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red hot hoochie coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail. Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. Hoody ho, hoody ho,
hoody ho.
Betty Boop and Cab Calloway, 1932, and Minnie the Moocher. Again, you can actually see the cartoon on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Our series is called Animating Music, looking at cartoons and tunes, and Will Friedwald is with me. He's author of A Biographical Guide to the Great Jazz and Pop Singers and Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies, A Complete Illustrated Guide to the Warner Brothers Cartoons. And we're talking about this really unexpected but very effective confluence of the hot jazz of the day, the hot singers and musicians of the day, with these Max Fleischer cartoon characters.
Well, to me, it's a very interesting confluence, as you say, because, again, to make the comparison to Disney, everything in a Disney film shows a sort of a reach for perfection. Disney was trying to get the story perfect, trying to get the characters right, trying to have music that would advance the story and tell you something about the character. And it was all, he was going to a very clear-cut goal, even from the beginning. Fleischer, on the other hand, they were trying to make funny cartoons. They were trying to, you know, animate to music. They were trying to have a good time. They don't have that kind of, you know, sort of same kind of mindset that Disney had. And to me, what makes the Fleischer films really appropriate for the use of jazz is that it's almost this improvisatory mindset that they had, and that, you know, the concept of jazz is that you take a melody and you elaborate on it. You know, you don't just play the melody as written, but you add, you know, you change something in the tune, then you add notes to it, you embellish, and then you add notes on top of the notes, then you embellish. Louis Armstrong once said, first I plays the melody, then I play the routine, then I routines the routine. And it's a famous, you know, that's the way he did it. And if you look at the Fleischer brothers, they're working on the same way. They take a story like Snow White, where Cab Calloway appears, and they add stuff to it. You know, they don't just give you the story, but, you know, every little bit they add as much as they can. Every frame, every 2 seconds is another little gag. There's stories that the Fleischer animators have where they said that the Fleischers, like Max and Dave, who ran the studio, didn't want there to even be like 3 seconds without a little joke, you know? And in fact, if you went for like 10 seconds without a joke, they had to add something to it. And somebody would say something like, oh, I'm stuck for a joke here. And somebody would say, well, how about we have, you know, the ceiling fall down and 5 icicles start dancing? You know, all this like random stuff. And it's totally, it has this kind of spontaneous feel. And, you know, the best Fleischer cartoons, you almost feel like they're being improvised, like they're making themselves up as they go along. And that's why it suits jazz so appropriately. That's why it's such a great marriage between the Fleischers and the great, you know, jazz musicians of the day, particularly Louis Armstrong.
Right. You know, you mentioned Louis Armstrong and, you know, the routines and all that. He appears with Betty Boop in also 1932 in this song called I'll Be Glad When You're Dead, You Rascal You. Louis Armstrong on the Betty Boop cartoon series. I'll Be Glad When You're Dead, You Rascal You, from 1932. Will Friedwald, Cab Calloway, Louis Armstrong, I mean, they had a sort of a crossover appeal, but they were black artists in an industry that was founded and at this point almost still exclusively white. What were the kind of racial politics of some of this animation?
Well, it's a fascinating thing because at the time, Paramount Pictures was really the first major studio to put Louis Armstrong on camera. I mean, what an obvious great idea, but they were the first to do it. And on his first film.
And just to go back to what you said before, they distributed these Fleischer
cartoons. Right, they were affiliated with the Fleischers were, you know, part of their organization.
Stable.
Right. And Paramount made two shorts with Louis Armstrong. One was a live-action film where he's wearing, like, a leopard skin and surrounded by soap bubbles. There's a theme, to, you know, along with Bunny Boy, there's a lot of bubbles in the show today. So he's surrounded by soap bubbles for no apparent reason and, you know, dressed like the King of the Jungle. And in the Fleischer cartoon, I'll Be Glad When You're Dead, Betty and Bembo are being chased by these cannibal headhunters, one of which sort of becomes this giant Louis Armstrong head in live action. Louis Armstrong's head is, like, shown hovering over the jungle. It's really surreal. And, yeah, that's sort of not too enlightened an image, you know, to show Louis Armstrong, you know, like a jungle savage. You know, I guess you have to take that along with it. I don't think anybody's that proud of that. But, you know, it is something to be proud of, the fact that the Fleischers really, you know, helped to create this great genius of American music. They really helped to get him on screen in some form. And that was probably, that was about the only way that, you know, black entertainers were depicted in film at the time. Not particularly politically correct, but, you know, we're still grateful to have that image. And it's still a great cartoon. I mean, to give the Fleischers whatever benefit there might be, they were presenting, you know, all races, especially, I mean, you know, whenever there's a Jewish character in one of these films, he's really, like, you know, not anything like a role model. There's a Jewish character in the middle of Saying You Sinners who just comes and shrugs. So it's not like they were playing favorites.
They were cartoons,
exactly.
After
they were
all.
Cartoons, exactly.
Wilfried Wald is the author of a number of books, among them Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies, A Complete Illustrated Guide to the Warner Brothers Cartoons. Will, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank
on
you. It's
Soundcheck
a great
today.
Series. I'm going to listen to the whole thing.
It's called Animating Music. And tomorrow we'll take a look at Walt Disney, who also got into the jazz scene by hiring Louis Prima to sing this song from Jungle Book.
And stroll right into town and be just like the other men. I'm tired of walking around. Oh, ooby-doo. I want to be like you.
And still to come, Etienne Charles and his band playing their take on Calypso classics live in the Soundcheck studio next.